Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status helps educators at every level take control of student data for increased outcomes and meaningful stakeholder engagement. Find out more at schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, episode 260, and I'm your host, Nick Ortigo. This episode, one school district used AI to craft their AI guidelines, but it's not as crazy as it sounds. Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each episode, we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, we hear from a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This episode, restorative practices. What are they and how can you implement them? Our guest tells us. Hello, everybody. Nick Ortigo here, and I'm joined by friend, assistant superintendent, as well as co-host of the Class Dismissed podcast, Dr. Christina Pollard. Did you catch that? Assistant.
That sounds so good.
Superintendent, Dr. Christina Pollard. I mean, Christina, do you just
so
like...
So many changes.
I know, but I'm so happy for you, and I think that's great. Do you want to share with us like what's going on? You're getting ready to be assistant superintendent
yes.
at a new district?
So we talked about how I defended my dissertation back in December. I'm officially Dr. Pollard, and I've accepted a position as assistant superintendent in Central Mississippi. So I'm going to be making a transition pretty soon, and I'm really excited about it.
Well, we're excited for you. Congratulations on all that. I just think that's the coolest thing. We've got a topic today that I want to talk about. That I think is, if it hasn't come across your radar yet, it's going to. And I know we do talk a lot about generative AI, ChatGPT on this show, but it's just such a hot topic and it's
yes.
so formative in where we're headed in the future.
And I must say we were one of the first to bring it up and really discuss it.
I think so, judging by our web hits as well. Like that stuff has taken off because I think we were one of the first talking about it after it happened, at least in the, like in the idea of how will this Yeah, how will this impact schools? And that was, I think, late November or early December of not 2023, but 2022, I think, is when we started having that
yes.
conversation. So there was an article in EdWeek about a district in Washington State. It's the Peninsula School District in Washington State. And they are among some of the first school systems in the country to put what they call their artificial intelligence or ChatGPT guidelines online for other school districts to see, okay? Because it's like how do we address this? What are our policies and so forth? And the reason they said they needed to do this is because teachers who had students that were using AI were like, hey, like, how do I navigate this? I need to, you know, I don't want to stick my neck out.
Some guidance.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's like, you know, they need to know, you know, how they deal if a parent complains or if a student, you know, isn't following the rules. Or how does a teacher like use AI in the classroom in terms of, you know, maybe coming up with curriculum or something? You know, you just need to kind of know, like, what do we need to do?
I certainly hope not.
Right. Well, I mean, essentially it's gathering all this information, so it might give you a starting point, but just certainly that shouldn't be the end all be all. And I think that's kind of why they needed the guidelines. What's funny is this school district, who, by the way, is now getting 600 hits a month on their website because people are interested in what they're doing, they actually wrote this policy, these guidelines, using ChatGPT. And what are your thoughts on that on the surface? And I'll get more in depth in what they did.
Well, I think that's extremely clever. First and foremost, I just want to say that I'm glad we were one of the first to begin talking about AI and ChatGPT. And it has definitely taken the country and classrooms by storm. I think that this district is being very proactive by putting things out there for us to see. But the fact that they actually used artificial intelligence to help create their guidelines, it says a lot. I think what it is going to do is two things. One, it may show teachers just how the information can be generated. We don't want to block it from education. We want to teach people the proper way to use it. So that's one step. But then two, I hope at the end of their guidelines that they use a list of references where they cross-checked information and made sure that the guidelines that they put out were legit. And that's another learning set for teachers.
And 100%. And I think their example of how they put this together is really a good example of how AI should be used in any you know, capacity. So here's what they did. They first started with the U.S. Department of Education. They actually came out with their own document around teaching and learning with artificial intelligence. So they took that one document. And then the guy who was putting the policy together from the district, he said he highlighted the 75-page PDF with everything that he felt like was important. So he just kind of took chunks of it. And then he actually coupled that with a few other documents that were out and about online or just kind of being passed around about generative AI. And then he dumped all that into ChatGPT. And he said, quote, give me a rough draft of a principles and beliefs document, like based off of everything I'm feeding into the system. So then he took also four pieces of his own writing and he said, had ChatGPT analyze those and then rewrite all the guidelines using his own voice and tone. And that became his first draft. Okay. So it's not like he like just was like, hey, give me guidelines. It was like, all right, here's what I have.
But that's a great learning tool, the way you describe that.
Exactly. And so now he's kind of like, look, like, we feel pretty confident with what we've created, you know, putting this together. Like, now feel free to go to our website and take what we did, at least use it as your framework, or do the same thing. Take what I have and take what you have and let ChatGPT kind of, you know, digest it and spit it back out and see what you end up with. But as long as I think you're using it as a piece of the pie and not the whole pie, I feel like that's not a bad way to go.
Well, quick question. Let me ask you this. What if any educator generates a passage or a body of text? Will AI or ChatGPT rewrite that text for you?
I do it all the time. Yeah. Like, okay. I mean, like I will write stuff and I will put it in ChatGPT and be like, hey, help me say this in a more eloquent way or whatever, however you want to ask it. Is that what you mean?
My concern, yes. But I think my concern as an educator is if we're doing that, but with someone else's work. And that even though it's being modified, you're not giving credit to the idea.
When I do it where I say, like, help me make this more eloquent, I think what I end up with is what I wrote using better verbiage. So it's not like I don't feel like in those cases it's pulling information.
Absolutely not.
But if I just like say, hey, give me, you know, write me guidelines on X, Y, or Z, then it's going to be pulling from all different sources all over the internet and essentially churning out its own thing.
And then does it give you a list of those sources?
No. And that is the trouble with generative AI. And that's why you hear, like, even like WordPress, for example. Do you know what WordPress is? They're basically, they're like the website builder, right? They apparently are either just signed or about to sign something where they're now going to take all the data that millions of people have put on their websites, and they're going to feed that. They're going to sell that data to ChatGPT. But what's happening is, in the past, like, we've always, the internet's always allowed for people to pull stuff from other sources, right? Like, you could always, like, it's a little bit of the Wild West, and you could always be like, hey, you know, there's this website here says X, Y, and Z, and you can go read more about it here. But there was like an exchange of information. Like, you would always get directed to that website, right? Even though another website may be using that info. But with ChatGPT and others like it, it's just basically, for lack of a better term, stealing the data and putting it out there without sourcing it. And that is the danger. And that is the concern.
And that is a lack of integrity. And that is a problem for the education world. And I'll give you an example. You know that I'm a recent doctoral candidate, and I'm still connected to our platforms in the graduate program. Right. And our dean literally had to send an email just yesterday reminding everyone that ChatGPT and artificial intelligence is not appropriate in the research world. And it's unfortunate that she had to discuss that with doctoral students, but it is real. And I will tell you that school districts all over our country, and specifically even in our state, they are putting together policies about artificial intelligence and ChatGPT specifically. And just knowing that districts are being required to do that or are concerned about it, it makes my heart happy to know that they're addressing it. But if they don't address it coupled with professional development, like literally they need sessions on how to use AI in your classroom appropriately. And if they're not doing that, then the policies really just hurt you with something that's new out in the, you know, innovation or technology world. It just reminds me of when the World Wide Web was created and so many parents and so many people were against it. Protect your children, guard it. You know, what is this internet thing? And so we just, I just see us behaving that same way. If we don't, one, truly try to embrace it and find out how it's, you know, going to drive the future, and then teach people the right way to use it and to teach their children how to use it.
I think you and I are saying this, about to say the same thing, like Pandora's box is open. So it's like, we've got to figure this out. Like, we can't go back, right? We can't go back to, hey, this thing doesn't exist. Don't look at it. Don't use it. Definitely. And in fact, in a workplace, like I saw the head of NVIDIA, like the software company, it's not even a software company, they're like a chip company, and they make all sorts of incredible computer products. But he basically was saying, like, 5 years ago, I would have told you to become a software engineer. Now I'm going to tell you how you need to learn how to use artificial intelligence to write code and navigate it and so forth. Like, it's changing that quickly. And I guess all we can do is kind of look at, like, you know, what are these other districts doing, and evaluate, is it the right thing? And like, when I look at some of the policies from this one district in Washington, for example, like they say, some of the things like effort matters. If you don't take the time to think through and carefully write your prompts to the into AI, you may not get excellent results. It'll require practice and patience to get better results. They say, don't blindly trust AI's response. If the AI gives you a fact or a number, remember that you will be responsible for the accuracy of the information you use in your work, even if it comes from AI. So it's like, it's a whole list of things like that. So, you know, do they have the right answers? Maybe not, but they do have some answers, and I think it's worth looking at.
Well, I just know that there's a lot that I need to learn about it, and I'm not against it, but it does concern me. I mean, I may teach some classes in the future, and I've got to learn how to navigate that with undergraduate students.
I mean, I saw this one thing, and I hate to go down this rabbit hole, but it was a guy, and he was on an interview with somebody else. And I don't know if this was like staged for the internet or whatever, but he was on a Zoom interview with somebody. Cause you know, you do several Zoom interviews and during the interview process. And he literally had an artificial intelligence thing listening to what the questions were being asked and then writing prompts. And then he's reading the answers from AI off his screen. So he's getting asked these complex questions and a computer's putting the answers on the screen. And then he's saying them. Since he's looking at a screen, he's just basically reading. So ultimately you had a person interviewing AI rather than a human, and they didn't know it. And it's just like, yeah, so you can be deceitful with it, no doubt. And it's like, how do we navigate this?
That's awful, by the way.
Right. No, it is awful. And it's scary. Like, it's scary to think that like somebody might get a job because a computer told them what to say in the interview process. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, what I'm going to do is, because this district does kind of seem to be leading the way a little bit with their guidelines, is I'm going to link their website, which has their guidelines, to our show notes. If somebody wants to take a look at it, knock your socks off. And
I definitely do.
Yeah. So we'll see how things turn out. Christina, are you ready for today's bright idea?
Yes, let's go.
Our guest in today's Bright Idea segment is one of the authors of Hacking School Discipline. Nathan Maynard studied behavioral neuroscience at Purdue, and he has been facilitating restorative practices for over 10 years. Nathan, welcome to Class Dismissed.
Yeah, thank you.
That term, restorative practices, before I even dive into anything else, much of your book, Hacking School Discipline, revolves around it. But to help me and our listeners understand, what exactly does that mean?
Yeah, so restorative practices is the way that we approach each student when they're in conflict or to be preventative with that student. So what that means is we really focus on the relationships, building up those relationships. If relationships get damaged, how to repair those relationships with the students as well as ourselves. It's about letting them see, you know, where we're coming from, that empathy piece, as well as us understanding where they're coming from, their empathy piece as well. Restorative practices implements logical and restorative consequences. And what restorative consequences means is the way that if you do something wrong, you have to repair the harm for what you did wrong. So it's really looking at each situation individually, seeking to understand behaviors as well as being preventative, and then building those relationships back up if there's ever damage.
So I understand this right. If a child got in a fight in school, what's an example of not using restorative practices and what's an example of using it?
Yeah. So let's say, you got two students that get into an altercation fight, and typically some systems, what they would do is you would label that behavior and say, okay, this is your first fight. That's going to be a 3-day suspension. After that 3 days, we're going to have you come back in. There might be a little bit of a touch base, but you know, that's normally the process. With restorative practices, what it does is say, okay, let's talk to both these individuals. Let's see what de-escalation, you know, I need to put into place. Because sometimes you do need to also have a suspension in place. But when those students return, or if they didn't end up leaving and they went to some sort of in-school suspension where they're away from each other, when they return, what you would want to do is do a conference with those two students and their parents. And during that conference, you ask a lot of empathy-driving questions, understanding how the other person felt, how the parents felt, how a fight really becomes a ripple effect for the entire climate of that classroom or that school, and then letting those two students understand how they impacted everyone else. After one of those conferences, you know, what we do is we come up with a plan of action about how to move forward and any other steps we need to take to repair the harm with what they harmed in that school. So what it does is really builds up those two students back up as a whole. So then they feel like everything's being addressed. The parents feel like they're being heard as well. The teachers that were involved with the situation can be brought in so they feel like they can be heard. And then when they come back into that climate, they're reintegrated instead of just saying, okay, you're suspended, go for 3 days, come back in, don't do that again. It's more of a, hey, we're all in this together. Let's build each other back up. And these conferences don't take much time. You know, I mean, you could spend 30 minutes on one of these conferences when they're returning to school, and it does wonders for the different schools. And I think that's why so many people are picking up on these practices.
Well, and so you and your colleague, Brad Weinstein, you guys decided to write this book, Hacking School Discipline. But what was your motivation for doing it?
Yeah, so Brad and I, we were working together at Purdue Polytechnic High School. He was director of curriculum, and I was the dean of culture there, so I dealt with the discipline. Brad came in, and he had this really cool Google spreadsheet that he was using at a different school to track behaviors. And it was this big, you know, situation where we wanted to integrate that with our systems, but I was doing restorative practices. So him and I started a lot of conversations back and forth about how to be restorative with sort of the spreadsheet, as well as I was passing on some of the, you know, my background with the restorative, and he was passing on some of his background with mindfulness and other components. We started talking, and Brad had a relationship with the publisher, Mark Barnes. And so then from there, we pitched the idea to him about some sort of restorative discipline, restorative practices. And Mark was, you know, all on board. So him and I sat down together and we started laying that out. And, you know, when we were writing this book too, we didn't want to just focus on restorative practices or restorative justice. We really wanted to focus on the social emotional aspects of students, as well as trauma informed care when you're dealing with different students. And that's the seeking to understand with different behaviors, because one student throwing something and another student throwing something doesn't mean the same thing. You know, sometimes there's other factors involved. So you can't always do the same consequence for each and every individual. And that's what restorative consequences help set those schools up for success with.
And so you guys designed the book where you can kind of break it down into the chapters, of course, but they're each one's kind of a common problem that schools face, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. That's how we break them.
And I'm going to ask you to do something that's difficult, which is like, you know, picking your favorite child. But like, if there was one that kind of really, you know, you wanted to tell someone about right now, which one of those would it be?
Yeah. I love the chapter where it's let's talk. Because that's really about seeking to understand those behaviors and keeping those relationships going with the students. One of the reasons why I like that chapter the most is because all my students that I've ever dealt with, you know, over the, you know, several years, they always joke around with me. And they always say, oh, Mr. Maynard, he wants to talk to me. I'm not in trouble. He just wants to talk. And it's always been like this laughing joke. But again, when a student's acting up in class, instead of having a resource officer come grab them or having, you know, three people say, get out of here, let's go. You know, I come in and say, hey, I just need to talk to you for a moment. And it really creates this culture of, hey, you know, like we're in this together. I'm not going to jump on, you know, the immediate referral, because sometimes I get those referrals down where, you know, students acting out in class, and I want to understand every side of it. So I hear the teacher, I take that in, and then I bring out that student. I understand where they're coming from, and then I make sure that that consequence is restorative and logical and matches up with repairing the harm with that teacher, because I don't want to just have them come out and have a long conversation with me and then me bring them back into the classroom. I want to make sure I'm fixing that all the way around. So that chapter really dives into what restorative practices can do for school admin like myself, as well as so the teachers understand what that process looks like also. And then they can do that, you know, throughout their classrooms. So let's say a student's acting, you know, out, instead of saying, come go out in the hallway right now, you can say, hey, let's talk, bring them out there, do a quick restorative conversation. You can do some sort of victim mediation if you have like two students that are sort of picking on each other, and you can do those really quickly with that chapter.
What I loved what you said earlier, and I don't know if anyone else listening caught this, but you said you're the dean of culture, which, and you handle discipline, but that title alone, I don't know if it was you that came up with that or if this has always been established.
It was, yeah.
It's pretty brilliant, right? I mean, it sets the tone, does it not?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So when we were starting this school, we started it 2 years ago, and it's a very different type of model. We were coming up with what my role would be. So there's a lot of different options out there on the table. And I really wanted that not just to be a dean of students or a discipline type. I wanted it to be about culture building. So anytime that there's any professional developments, building up other staff members, helping with those student discipline problems, family nights, you know, that's my role. So my role is really about that culture of the building, maintaining that and keeping that a healthy culture.
I know in the book you make a point to caution teachers of doing something that may actually be happening this summer. And that is, be careful to go to a teacher that has an incoming student and saying, hey, watch out for that child. He's a little bit of a troublemaker, right? You suggest, yep, don't pass that information on to the other teacher.
Yes. Yeah. And again, it's fine to communicate different, you know, aspects of that student and to go over. But when you say something like that, you're really quickly labeling that student. So if you do want to, you know, because it's fine to communicate when the student's struggling, because you don't want this other teacher to come in there and you've learned a year's worth of data on the student, and then you want them to be, you know, blindsided by some of these situations that the student's struggling with. But again, too, when you say these are the bad kids, these are the good kids. I've heard a teacher before, I was doing a professional development recently, and she said when she first started, the senior teacher sat her down and said, those four are going to go to college. These five are going to go work in the factory. These two are going to do this. And those two over there are going to go to prison. And when they label something like that, you know, even if that teacher comes in, yeah. And even when that teacher comes in and looks at that situation, they still have those, you know, ideas in the back of their head. So it's so much easier to say, like, these students over here are really good at math. These ones over here loved recess. So that's a good incentive for them, you know, and just sort of build the students up. And if a student really does struggle, you know, you can put that in a strength-based language. And the teacher that was telling me is a little bit older, so she had some of those, you know, generational pass downs. But again, so we have to fight to stop that. Because again, when we pass down seeing these are the rough kids, these are the bad kids, or these are the kids that you could go into prison, which is extreme, you know, that really puts these thoughts in teachers' heads when they see that student walk in the door, even if they're trying to actively not think of.
There's multiple types of data that schools now have at their fingertips. You know, you've got your academic data, but then you also have that discipline data. How would you advise educators to be using the discipline data?
Yeah, so I'm a strong believer in the multi-tiered systems of support, the MTSS model. I think that, you know, there's the response to intervention model, the RTI model, but I really think MTSS is where, you know, a lot of states are going towards right now, and I really think that's the way that you support your students. So I think you can use that discipline data with tracking what tiers those students would be into. Are they tier one, tier two, and tier three students, and then what sort of supports you can offer for each one of the students. I do think when you're looking at the discipline data, you have to come up with universal approaches that are going to hit all three of those different tiers. I think that's what restorative practices offer, is looking at all of that as a whole.
Have you been surprised, and have you guys made much penetration in the world of like spreading the word of restorative practices? Like how common was that concept, and how much progress have you made in telling everyone about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're very surprised with how popular the book's been. I'm looking on Twitter, seeing people take pictures of it, you know, having people quote different aspects of it. It's so it makes us feel so well, because, you know, we're thinking about, you know, when I'm dealing with, you know, the, you know, my 300 students at my school, or Brad's, you know, helping out with his school, because he was a principal prior to coming over to Purdue Polytechnic High School. You know, what we're thinking about is every one of these teachers, we're impacting their entire classrooms if they're going to try this practices. So we're really spreading the word so quickly through, you know, just these books being, you know, out there and people checking them out. So I think that's a huge penetration. Restorative practices as a whole has been out there for a while. It really got started in the early, like, or the late 80s with the International Institute of Restorative Practices, who trained me back in 2008. And they're a great institute. So that's how I got trained. And I started doing it with students, or not students, but kids that were in the juvenile justice field. So I did that for 8 years prior to going into education. In the education realm, there's not a lot out there of them doing restorative practices at the time after when I was getting trained back in 2008. Now it's a lot more out there and a lot more people are doing it, but I still think that there's a lot of steps to be taken. Brad and I have been going around and we're doing professional developments at different schools, because there's a lot of big organizations that do amazing trainings how to get trained. What Brad and I really focus on are how to make this digestible in the classroom quickly, and the quick takeaways that they can have. So again, when we're going in and doing these professional developments, you know, we're partnering with close to, I think it's like 15 to 20 school districts this upcoming year to help them out with restorative practices. Also on an international level, I recently got back from Belgium. I spoke at Kortage, Belgium, to talk about some a taxonomy of restorative practices in the school. So I wanted to talk to a lot of people that's been in the field for a long time about that. So I went over to Belgium and spoke about that as well.
I've got to ask, because you said you had a background in juvenile justice, and that's interesting. Like, what was your takeaway from that part of your career headed into education?
Yeah, so it was the best thing that's ever happened to me, in all honesty. I started out, I was 21 years old. You know, I graduated behavioral neuroscience degree. I really wanted to work with at-risk and underserved, underprivileged populations. So I started working at a residential treatment care center as a full-time staff. I ran a violent and sex offender unit for 3 years. And then I moved up and I went into a clinical role. But after a while, it really just opens up your eyes to these stories of these kids. So when I'm going into education, I know the background of some of these kids that have had such a rough background, and going into their homes or working with their families or having them come into the residential treatment care center, taking them to court, you know, writing these, you know, reports about their lives, about everything that's happened to them. It really makes you think, like, you know, if I saw this kid walking on the street, I'd say, oh, that kid looks like, you know, he's probably not doing the best, you know, life choices. I should probably walk on this side of the street. And then when you start digging in, you're like, man, he's had this happened to him. Like, this kid just needs someone to care about him. He needs someone to help him out. And that's what I've done in education. These tier three students, or these students that are underserved and underprivileged, I look at each one of them and say, like, they need someone on their side. They don't have a lot of people on their side. And I know it's tough. And I know that they'll act out and they'll call names and they'll steal something off your desk, but, like, they need support and they just don't know how to get it. So when we try to reach those students and try to help those students, there's so much we can do. And success for each one of those students is different. We can't say success for every student is A's and B's and going off to college. You know, success is different for every single one of students. And we have to praise their journey through school, even those ups and downs, and work through them with them. So I think working in the juvenile justice field, it really opened up my eyes to, you know, what we can do to support just ending every kid overall.
Well, Nathan, I got to tell you, it sounds like your background makes you like the perfect ambassador for restorative practices. Like, I mean, that's really is great. And I'm really excited that you and Brad put the book together. If somebody wants to keep up with either one of you guys, I mean, should they follow you on Twitter? Is that where you normally like to interact, or where do you hang out?
Yeah. Twitter's our biggest hangout spot right now. Brad and I also publish some blogs, so you can check out our blogs on behaviorflip.com. That's where we're posting most of our stuff right now, but yeah, Twitter's our big platform right now.
All right, well, thank you, Nathan. Are you ready for our pop quiz?
I am. Let's go.
All right, first question: if students could only go to school for one subject, which subject should it be?
Ooh, that's a good one. I would probably say English, just because I feel like you would have to learn how to communicate with others, read, you know, write, sort of get through, you know, those type of subjects.
What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
I would definitely say social emotional learning. I think the more we can teach that in every single classroom, even if you're teaching math or you're teaching English, what sort of social emotional aspects can you add to those lesson plans? How can you engage that student? Because, you know, we know that, you know, students, the neuroscience of their brain is not as fully functioning. So they fire with their amygdala very quickly, which is their flight or fight response. So what can we do to engage the rest of their brain so their hippocampus is remembering things? So that, you know, the prefrontal cortex is sort of laying out that context, because even little lessons can engage that rest of your brain. So what can we do to really activate all of that?
What does every child deserve?
I think every child deserves us to be patient, kind, and just willing to see them as a child and not label them, and just give them all a fresh start every single day, even if it's a repeated behavior.
What's the biggest challenge for today's educators?
I think balance. I think educators right now are stretched very, very thin. You have a lot of people, you know, looking at you. You have, you know, your principals, you have, you know, other people in the school, you have parents, you have students that, you know, you're trying to meet the needs of your classroom, trying to meet, you know, so many different, you know, aspects. And there's so much balance, you know, even like with restorative practices and social emotional learning, a lot of teachers hear and they're like, I don't have time for that. I have to do this, 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 and this, you know? So I think the balance is so hard for educators. It's a very tough field to, you know, keep that going.
What's the best gift to give an educator?
I think the gift of, I think most educators have it, but I would say patience. You know, I think that, you know, when going through that balance, that components, students with, you know, behavioral, you know, challenges, you know, I think that patience is a really good aspect they should, you know, every educator should have.
Which teacher changed your life?
I would definitely say I had a math teacher in eighth grade that really set me straight. I was struggling quite a bit when I was younger. And I really did not have plans to graduate high school by any means. And I was really struggling. And this math teacher, and I wasn't even that close to him, but I was doing an after-school detention. He was the one running it at the time. And he pulled me aside and he said, he was like, Nathan, do you like living here? Do you like, you know, Marion, Indiana? And I was like, right. No, I don't. And he was like, do you like your living with your parents? I'm like, I don't. And he's like, you're going to do this for a long time. You're going to stay here. You're not going to get out. You know, there's no ways out. He's like, you have to, you know, if you want to get out, you know, college is the easy way. You can take out student loans. You can, you know, do this stuff. And he started talking to me about it. And then I started, you know, high school that very next year. And then I graduated at the top of my class, you know, in the top 10. So like, I really turned it in, and I was getting D's and F's, and this math teacher did not even know me very well, but he just opened up my eyes and he saw that I was struggling, and he just made me think like, I don't want to live in Marion. So wow. I really turned it around.
That's like such a pivotal moment. Have you ever had a chance to reach out to him?
I haven't. Yeah. And in all honesty, this is sad, but I don't even remember his name. I didn't know him very well. I was so not engaged in school. I need to try to figure out who he was, because that just small conversation. And I mean, he talked to me for maybe 5 minutes, changed my entire outlook. Two of my really good friends, you know, are still struggling, you know, every day. And, right. And I see, you know, their different struggles and read about some of the stuff. And it's just, I think about, I was in that same path. I was dealing with that same stuff. You know, there's poverty, there's other stuff involved where I really overcame so much because of that small little conversation. I think that's why I push so many educators to have those conversations, because you never know whose life you're going to change. He doesn't know he changed my life. He doesn't know that now I'm reaching thousands and thousands of educators with my book. You know,
yeah, so, like, that's powerful. Yeah. That, like, if you ever reach out to him, I would love to hear the follow up on that. Because like, that's,
I need to figure out who. Yeah, I'm sure I can find out. So.
I mean, and what a lesson to educators listening. Of like you said, you know, you weren't his student, but still, he had that conversation. That's really cool.
Yeah. It was.
And last question: pen or pencil?
I'd say pencil. Just so you can always, you know, go back and erase and try something new.
All right. Again, the book is Hacking School Discipline. Nathan, we really appreciate you sharing these ideas of restorative practices, and hopefully you just continue to spread the word.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me on.
That That's going to do it for this episode of Class Dismissed. If you want to send us an idea or comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com or tweet us at Class Dismiss. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So please subscribe to the show. And we'd also appreciate it if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. On behalf of all the good people working at School Status and Christina, representing all those educators out there, thank you for listening. I'm Nick Ortigo, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class dismissed.